Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otto. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Daniel Atlin. Daniel Atlin is a coach, communicator, strategist, fundraiser, adjunct professor, and connector. With over 30 years' experience in senior roles in Canada's post-secondary, cooperative, and government sectors, Daniel specializes in helping complex, purpose-driven organizations and individuals navigate change and uncertainty. In his career as a leader at Guelph University, Daniel led a division of 100 employees focused on key external relationships, including communications, and was responsible for securing extremely large financial gifts for the university. Daniel is deeply passionate about change leadership and in 2024 completed the executive master's degree run by HEC Paris and Oxford Said Business School, which is where we met. His thesis on sense-making offered an innovative and timely framework to help social purpose leaders address complexity. Daniel says, leaders and board members must realize that hiring the same people with the same profile as the past won't make an organization ready for change, but instead reinforces the status quo. By recognizing the messiness of their organizations and using sense-making skills, leaders in social purpose organizations have better odds of surviving the perils and challenges of massive disruption and unprecedented change. Daniel Atlin, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Thanks, Charlotte. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's delightful to have you with us here in the studio today. So, Daniel, let's talk about that quote that the leaders of the past are not the leaders we need for the future, especially when it comes to universities. What makes the right kind of leader to take post-secondary into an unknown future?
Yes, well, I think, that's what I sort of looked at during my dissertation as well. And I think it takes a sense-making leader. And I did some research and defined sense-making as four skills that are wrapped around purpose. So I think a leader that needs to be able to navigate these uncertain times, especially for social purpose organizations, but also for the broader industry, I think, at large, would be exploration and map-making, storytelling and narrative development, invitation and improvisation, and adaptation and collaboration. I think all those things need to be done in tandem with sort of traditional management or leadership skills in order to really sort of, I think, supercharge the ability for an individual to be able to work with colleagues and drive change throughout the organization.
And Daniel, why is this so important for leaders of universities? Let's dig into a university culture and why the pressures of change and disruption are so acute and why sense-making is so necessary.
Thanks so much for the question. Universities are very unique organizations. They are multi-stakeholder. There's power is distributed completely through two bodies, main bodies, one of which is the board of directors or governors, the other of which is actually the Senate and the academic leadership. And so a leader actually doesn't have a lot of, I think, tangible hard levers to be able to pull, to be able to affect change. You have to actually do a lot of things more by influence. And as one of the people I interviewed said, by nudging. You have to become the nudger in chief to be able to get all these different forces all together. There's also an incredibly amount of multi-stakeholder bodies that you have to deal with. You have to deal with students, their parents, faculty, international students, the broader public, government, everyone you have to deal with. And everyone believes that they have a stake in you as well. So it makes it a great challenge to be able to deal with all these things. So I think that, in some ways, you know, we think that these are wonderful, you know, leadership roles and can be pillars of the community, when in fact, they're actually in some ways, you know, just stewards of a very large, complex, adaptive system rather than actually a traditional business.
I'm so glad you pointed that out to me, because I probably knew that instinctively or in the back of my brain, but I hadn't actually thought it through. And I come, as you know, from corporate, where an organization is a hierarchy with one leader at the apex, and that leader sits on the board, is obviously accountable to their board, but also can use a lot of influence to make sure the board does what they want to do. So that pressure on university leaders working in a matrix, that actually makes it a lot clearer to me how complex it is. Since you've done your research, where you spend time with a lot of university leaders and you're talking about it now and you're going on keynote stages and you're writing about it, what part of your research or what part of the sense-making framework do you find is landing the most with university leaders?
So I think, as in many, oftentimes, it's actually all these pieces coming together. And all these pieces coming together, actually, I think the most surprising thing was actually not the framework itself, was actually the recognition, exactly as you describe as well, as the mess, which is actually the context of these, you know, complex adaptive systems, like a university or a hospital or a large international nonprofit. They're actually in a very messy environment that actually requires a very different sort of attitude to be able to get things done and for leaders to be able to survive and be successful. So I think that was actually the biggest aha. And when I shared the dissertation back and the findings back, and I've been sort of on the road talking to people, a lot of people have thanked me, saying, thanks so much for pointing it out, pointing out the fact that, you know, people expect us to operate like traditional businesses or to lead like traditional leaders. Well, we can't, because we don't have those tools.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you know that I love the word messy. I find that such a useful way in to understand the system that people are in. So, Daniel, let's talk about you. Walk us through your leadership journey. I mean, at the end, you were running a huge organization, but during the process of becoming a leader and moving from one role to another, what did you learn about yourself as a leader?
Absolutely. Well, I think one thing that I learned is that how true the Nietzsche quote that lives can only be understood looking backwards, but have to be lived forwards. I think that that's so true, because I don't think I could have really anticipated my journey. So I started the journey. My first career was actually in the music industry. So in the 1980s, and I was doing sales and marketing, and actually owned a small company there. And that was my first time of really sort of seeing the effects of transformative change in society. And we got Napsterized with the advent of digital technologies, and I ended up having to shift my career as well, because I had to run away a little bit with almost this close to going bankrupt, very close to going bankrupt, and able to reinvent myself as well. So I actually, after that, I went into the government sector, where I was working for a minister of the Crown here in Canada, and was a communications and policy advisor. Left that role to become a government relations and public affairs director at a cooperative society here in Canada. And then after that, I decided that this was in some ways too easy. I could see myself coasting for the next several years. I saw an intriguing sort of advertisement for an associate vice president, government, institutional, and community relations at the University of Toronto. And I thought, wow, that sounds like an interesting sort of space. And so I joined that as well. Really enjoyed that. Moved up through the ranks, went through some interesting sort of discussions as I created a portfolio there. I was wooed over to become a vice president strategy and college affairs at Seneca College, Canada's largest college. And then after that, I was again enticed by a role here at Guelph, where I reside, and that was to become the vice president external at the University of Guelph, responsible for a new area again, which would be fundraising, alumni relations, government relations and community relations, and marketing and community traditional comms.
That is a lot of functions wrapped up in one department. Did that sometimes feel a little bit messy to you?
Yes, it was absolutely extremely messy. And it became messier and messier as time went on. I ended up becoming, in some ways, I think because of the nature of the role, and I think, as you point out in your book, it often is the case as well for people in charge of comms, that was becoming in some ways the chief advisor to the CEO and president on a whole bunch of different fronts. And during COVID and the crises that ensued after that, and also the Palestinian crisis that's played out here on university campuses in Canada and elsewhere, it became, you know, increasingly too much of a job. And with that, I left the role about 2 years ago. And I've reinvented myself in this chapter as a coach and executive advisor to complex institutions.
Yes, I love a bit of reinvention myself. I'm very pro. I'm pro reinvention, and I've been through several, so I support you in yours. So, Daniel, you know that diversity is a big topic for me, and I know it's important to you too. What does diversity mean for you as an individual, but also as a leader? And why do we still need to be talking about it?
Absolutely. Well, diversity is extremely important to me. And while I recognize my own privilege as a cis-born male, who in some ways won the lottery, I lived in Canada, I've got a loving family who books in my home. They supported me with encouraging my growth and post-secondary career. You know, I come from an interesting sort of background as well. I'd say that diversity matters to me so much because I saw it growing up. My parents got married in the 50s, and my father was Jewish. My mother was Anglican. And they experienced a lot of intolerance in the community. And I actually saw that throughout as well. When we lived in rural Canada for a while, saw that people actually, you know, othered you a little bit. So that sense of othering really, you know, has loomed large, and I think it's been made me recognize and sensitive and perhaps empathetic to the underdog and people who are marginalized as well. And then that especially, you know, came true when I realized in the late 80s that I was actually, you know, a gay man. So coming out at that time was very different than it is now, and realized again that you know, the world was not meant for and constructed by gay people and people of diverse backgrounds. It was for, you know, in large ways, a white patriarchy. So had to sort of adapt and live to that as well. So through that, I think I've been a champion of diversity, trying and inclusion to be able to sort of see that that's adapted in workplaces. For a while, I was actually the only, I think, out gay male in organizations and felt that I had a lot of on my shoulders to be able to represent that well. But I continue to sort of see this as actually, you know, needed to have role models, to have people that actually can demonstrate that they are actually, you know, of diverse communities to be able to lead the way as well. So that's, I think, how I would see how the importance of diversity is in the workplace.
So I really love your answer, and thank you so much for sharing, you know, your personal experience. And you talked about the challenges of coming out in the 80s for a while, being the only out person where you worked, but also that responsibility of representation. And one of the things that's been coming through very strongly for me, actually since writing We Need New Leaders, but talking about the intersection of reputation, leadership, and diversity, is that leaders who come from diverse backgrounds, diverse identities, or underrepresented minorities, when they live their reputation out loud, not only are they representing for others, they're also building bridges for the next generation to walk across. And I realize that it's not just for show, that it's actually a very powerful thing that you do when you live your reputation out loud as someone who is diverse in some way, that you're creating new bridges for emerging leaders to follow. Did you ever have a sense of that?
Absolutely. I think I had a sense of that. Some of it was actually quite explicit. I when I was in the credit union system, it was a very conservative sort of movement, you know, largely rural in nature. So some people said that I was the first gay person that they've ever encountered as well. And they said they were just so wonderful to see that, you know, I was just like them in so many different ways, describe relationships at home with the same issues, with a same-sex partner that a married individual with a traditional relationship would be. So I think that, you know, that dialogue was very healthy, I think, and actually adding, I think, oxygen onto perhaps, you know, a space that didn't actually, you know, receive it beforehand. And then I think I spent a lot of time, I think, trying to mentor and perhaps reach out to people who I see are vulnerable. They may not feel, you know, included. I want to make certain that everyone not only is invited in the workplace, but actually feels that they're invited. And I think that I can do a lot to help them feel invited into an organization.
Oh, that's such a beautiful answer. And to me, it feels like that chimes with your coaching experience. So after finishing your executive master's, the program that we were on together, you've gone on to get your certification as an EMCC coach, and you've also done various other certifications. And I can imagine that for you, coaching must fulfill some of that element of wanting to help others and wanting to be there for another person. Am I summarizing correctly?
Absolutely, that's correct. I really want to help. I want to give back in some ways, pay it forward as well. I see that this is so important to unlock talent and unlock individuals' potential as well. You know, coaching is really to help, you know, people become their best versions of themselves, you know, for whatever the time and whatever their issue they're working on. And that's what I would do. I've also been fortunate to join a recruiting firm as well, an executive recruiting firm that actually focuses on, you know, what we call equity, diversity and inclusion here in Canada. And that's called the Griffith Group. And it's wonderful to be associated with a firm that lives its values, that actually explicitly wants to take new types of leaders and promote them into positions of traditionally what you would call power.
Oh, I love that. That's must be very, very satisfying to work with an organization that's actually living its values and not just talking about them. And Daniel, do you think about your own reputation? And if so, how?
So absolutely, I think about my own reputation. And I think about, you know, the power of you have as a role to be actually that role model, and how people, you know, see you and sometimes, you know, put you in a different position that's beyond you might what you may feel like as an individual. I was a senior, you know, executive at a major organization in a very small community. So I felt like I lived that reputation sort of every day as well. And one thing that has been very, very, you know, important to me going forward has been always remembering the influence that you could have as well. And that's positive and also potentially disruptive as well. And I always have kept the quote of Maya Angelou sort of quite close to me. And that's that people will forget what you said, they'll forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And to me, that was so important. And it was so important that I actually gave a portfolio with that quote on it to every person in my division at the University of Guelph, to be able to recognize that people matter, its feelings matter as well, as they're more important or as equally important sometimes as your actions.
It's such a beautiful quote. And that came back to me, as you know, I've been deep in the marketing of my book, and it came back to me when somebody who had not been in my team, but when they joined the organization I was in, I had a welcome to the organization chat with them and made some introductions. They are now working not in that organization, in a completely different business for somebody they met through me. And she just wrote this beautiful LinkedIn post saying, you know, how, when you make people feel welcome, that stays with people. And that was very touching for me to see. I'm so glad you mentioned your team. I'd like to talk a little bit about your leadership style, how you how you felt you showed up as a leader and how you liked to lead?
Absolutely. Well, sometimes I actually get uncomfortable with the word leader, actually, even though I use it a lot in my writing and education. And I think it's because, you know, we tend to think that leaders are on almost pedestals where actually they're maybe, you know, on their tippy toes, you know, in a crowd as opposed to on much of a pedestal. But I would try and be, I would say empathetic leader. I would try and put recognition that, you know, yes, you have to work on the objectives of the organization, but you also have to try and collectively empower people as well and bring them along too. Recognize the importance of communications and not a surprise to you, I'm sure, but the need to be consistent and also be able to be open for two-way communication with various people across your team as well. Very early on when I joined this organization, you know, and organizations are always, you know, unique cultures and you have to adapt. I went on a listening tour. So I ended up making certain that I went to all the other, you know, senior leaders and deans and associate vice presidents and went to their offices and actually met with them to hear about their issues and listen to them. Listening is, I think, a key part that sometimes leaders actually forget. They tend to speak more than they listen, and I think that that's important. I would try and spend a lot of time on building a proper culture as well for my division and area. When I had joined the university, it was a poorly performing, I'd say, and seemed to as a place you would go and park yourself for a short little period of time till you got another sort of job. Together, though, by involving the organization, we did a little bit of an audit of it. Talked to people throughout the organization, found out what was working, what wasn't, and there was a lot that wasn't working. And I remember standing in front of that group and reporting back about what other people were feeling about the group that I led. And it wasn't a very positive feeling, and people you could see were feeling a little bit hurt. So then I turned the conversation. I said, together, let's actually turn this around. And we actually did turn it around. We established a bottom up as well as a little bit of top down by sending direction and setting the context, but way to be able to turn around that place and make it more people oriented, less process oriented. We turned around, but it aspirational as well, doubling the size of actually what we would be getting in terms of donations on an annual basis from $25 to $50 million. And we actually created an aspirational culture, which I think actually really served the place well. But one thing that I did, which actually I found was very, very effective, was monthly I didn't call it this, but they called it Danishes with Daniel. I did an all division sort of meeting where I would get together and offer coffee and Danishes and fruit. And people could, talk to me about anything. I usually then, gave a short little talk about maybe 5 minutes and entertain questions. I demonstrated my vulnerability sometimes there, especially early on, that I was new, that I felt a little bit of imposter syndrome. But that's okay, because together we can actually, make things happen. So I think that did a lot to foment and cultivate a really strong culture, I'd say, of caring and people that wanted to stay. The turnaround of the culture was significant, and now it became sort of a culture that actually attracted people and was actually, seen as perhaps one of the beacons of light actually at the university.
Such a great story, and it makes me think, it sounds to me like a really successful change initiative in which you spent a lot of time listening, took the feedback to heart, and then went back to your team and worked bottom up with them as to, how can we change this organization so that, we become more effective, that our audiences and stakeholders admire us and want to work with us, but effectively also fixing our reputation. And you and I have studied change, and one of the challenges with change is actually getting organizations to change. And I really do think that listening is undervalued as a tool in effecting change. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Absolutely, I think that's correct. And you know, one of the books that I quite liked that they, or the readings they had for our program, was actually the Humble Consulting by Edgar Schon. I think I really appreciated that, and because it allowed, it was one of those exercises that really made you allow the power of good questions, and sometimes the power of a little bit of pause too. That you know, those two in combination can sometimes actually do wonders in actually making change happen, getting people empowered, getting people to realize, I think, sometimes that they have the personal change elements within them as well. They just have to tap into them.
Yeah, that's such a great answer. And it just makes me think, so many change initiatives that I've seen have all been about broadcasting from the top, which in the end is acting with a lack of empathy. It's also acting with that kind of top-down mentality. But we know those ones, just they don't succeed.
And that's why I think in a lot of ways I'm not usually a big fan of things like strategic planning and huge, administrative laden, I'd say, in metrics, ROI-ridden KPIs that actually are thrust upon an organization. Because I think sometimes they actually stifle conversations and true change as well. Changes usually happen not sort of at the center of an organization, but at the periphery and at the edges. And I think a better way to somehow do that is to capture those things with a broad strategic direction rather than actually a plan that actually tries to nail down and predict the future, which, as we know, is unpredictable.
Yeah, and so many organizations get obsessed with that plan. I've seen it so many times sitting in on project meetings where the traffic lights like red, orange, green, and it's a complete horror. And I'm sitting there as a communicator thinking, well, you clearly love your project plan very well, but I can't match this to the humans that I'm supposed to be communicating with. So I do think changes on the periphery, thinking about the human beings involved, those are really the key, some of the key elements of change. So Daniel, as you know, the big thing for me is changing the leadership archetype, that picture we have in our brain of what a leader looks like. And it goes back to your quote at the beginning that boards need to start to think about different kinds of leaders. What do you think we can do both collectively and as individuals to change the old leadership archetype?
Well, thanks so much for that question. And it's one that I, you know, think a lot, and I used to think a lot when I was doing hiring as well. First of all is, you know, take a risk. You know, don't hire the same people. You know, while you're not supposed to think about fit in an organization while you're doing the recruitment, so oftentimes that's an undertone, I think, and some people actually use that as a frame to make decisions. And I think, you know, fit is relatively dangerous in some ways, because that means you're actually looking backwards. You're looking for what was the culture that has worked and got us to here, not which will take us to the next level. So I think thinking about people who have potential, think about people that may be a slightly disruptive. We learned about that perceived weirdness index. And I think, you know, having someone that can push that index a little bit to be able to make that certain that you can actually have some change. I think that that's very, very important. I have been known to taking some bold chances, I think, on hiring people. And I'd say 90% of the time they've worked out. And actually, I've hired people with extremely high potential. That's lucky for me, because now I can keep them in my network, and I can continue sort of drawing on them as we mentor each other, I say, going forward. And so I think it's actually take a risk, make sure that you're actually trying to actively, you know, do a little bit of a provocation to the status quo in order to make things different.
I love that, because it makes hiring quite a rebellious act, which would certainly have inspired me as a leader if I'd thought of it. So Dan, now we get to the three questions I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
So I'm going to give you two recommendations, if that's okay. Because one of which is actually, you know, I just finished last week, and although it came out last year, it's really got my mind thinking about the future. And that's Nexus by Yuval Noah Harari. And that's all about, you know, what we're going through now. We're in the midst of this tsunami of change brought upon by AI and new technologies. And it talks a lot about the potential, but also a lot of the challenges as well. And it really got me thinking about how the history of data, you know, has informed where we are today, and in some way supported the status quo. So I think in a lot of ways we have to take a look and see what we can do to use it as a AI and other things as a positive disruptor rather than reinforcing, where we've always been. So the second book is actually one that, we were introduced to at the program, and it opened up something in me which I was really surprised that I jumped in and embraced. And it's called Do Improvise by Robert Poynton. It's a little book that talks about the importance of improvisation and being able to incorporate that into your daily life. And I do think that, for the times we are in, improvisation is probably the skill you need for 2025 and beyond, because we are in a totally unpredictable world where people have too much information and have to continually improvise. And being comfortable with that will be one of those big survival tactics that you can have.
I love that. So you've recommended a big, fat, chunky book and then a slender book. And I will say that on the topic of improvisation, I think it's part of the reason why podcasting has become such a joy for me, because although I plan out the questions, I don't know what my interviewee is going to say, and I like to have questions that respond to their words. And it's really tested me in terms of learning to be in the moment, learning to let go of control, and learning to go off script, which is something I always recommend to leaders. And so I can now legitimately recommend it to leaders because it's something that I'm pushing myself to do, is be in the moment and learn to improvise. So thank you so much for recommending that. So Dan, as you know, the passion for me is how do we get a new cohort of diverse leaders into leadership. They have ambitions to lead. They want to land a leadership role. They want to keep a leadership role because landing and keeping is often not the same thing. Or they want to create a job for themselves by starting their own business. What are your three tips for emerging leaders from diverse backgrounds?
So my first tip is certainly, what I talked about earlier on is actually, speak to people, be open to speaking to people who have gone before you. Reach out to your network. I find that, people in your old-fashioned Rolodex, or on LinkedIn or in other social media platforms, they're usually actually very open to having an information conversation about how they came about. Again, it comes to that power of questions. People love to be asked. They love to be able to share their own journeys. So reach out to people. You'll be surprised what you learn. You may be surprised what mentors you'll get actually along the way as well. So the second thing I would say is actually, be cognizant that, organizations are changing as well, even as we speak. You come into an organization and it's not the organization you thought it was. It's actually a different one. It's like jumping into a river. Leaders will change, dynamics will change. You may have a wonderful job and a wonderful leader, but if that leader changes, your job can change quite significantly. So recognize always that it's your role to be responsible for your own happiness at work in some ways. You are in control of your future as well. And if there's something that's jarring and that's against your values, then choose to find a way to probably exit that organization or have a path to be able to help you become who you want to be as well. And then the third thing I'd say is actually sometimes, push back at being identified as the marginalized person or a marginalized representative. You may get asked a lot to do things, or because of your background, or because of how you look, because of how you think, because of some underlying condition you may have. In some ways, that can get exhausting as well. Set boundaries and push back, because you have to recognize that you don't want to be, a token person at a place. You don't want to actually be seen as one small part of your identity, or a large part is your complete identity as well. That sort of goes with that hand in hand with that, advice that was provided by someone else about being kind to yourself. Always be kind to yourself, because you're no one, not everyone will be.
Oh, those are such lovely tips. I'm going to repeat them back. So number one was network and meet people outside your network and ask questions, because you'll be surprised at how willing people are to give advice. Number two, be prepared for change and change, and at this, in the same token, be responsible for your own happiness, because you may need to choose to leave if your organization changes and starts to espouse values or have leaders that you don't respect. And thirdly, if you are of a diverse background or identity, be kind to yourself. Don't allow yourself to be tokenized, and don't allow yourself to always be used as the representative of that marginalized community. And I think that's such wise and empathetic advice. So thank you for that. And my last question, now you referred to it when you talked about Nexus. We're living in a weird, wild, wonderful, and crazy time. We all have to take care of ourselves. What brings you joy?
So it depends on the day, I think. But usually it's actually this, Charlotte. You and I think, know a few things that give us joy that we shared in common. I think that's why we connected so well during our course. One thing that gives me great joy is actually great conversations with great ideas that are emergent as well. So I love, that's probably why I like your podcast, and while I'm going to start my own as well. And I really, really find that that's fantastic. And I love it, especially when you're surprised by a conversation. A conversation takes a turn. You have a discovery that you didn't expect about a person or about some new ideas, and your serotonin starts tingling. That's actually one of those great sort of joys in life. But the other thing that gives me joy is the complete contrast. And that's actually time by myself, whether it's walking in a forest. We both love forest walking. Or whether it's actually gardening as well, and just being out and just trying to tend one's garden, sort of literally and metaphorically. The ideas that come to you, what might be me while I'm walking or gardening, are just actually, I think, really some of the best ones that I've had. And I think those are two things that give me incredible joy.
Well, those are two answers I can strongly relate to, because I think you and I are very similar. But Daniel, I feel like there was a bombshell in there that we maybe have to unpack. You mentioned that you're starting your own podcast. Yay! Do you want to tell us something about it?
Yeah, well, thanks, Charlotte. And you know, I've said this before, but in some ways, you know, I'm one of the joys of the program was actually meeting you as well. And actually, you know, in some ways, you've been a trailblazer for me. So I appreciate that. And watching you and the success you've had has made me think, I think I have a podcast in me as well. And also, especially, you know, as I said, I love helping organizations, mentoring people, and then actually, I think, you know, coming up with new ideas. So my podcast will be out, soon, this fall, and it's called Messy. It's talking to leaders of complex, you know, purpose-based organizations about how they deal with the mess of leadership in their incredibly messy organizations.
Well, I'm going to say to all my listeners, make sure that you put that in your diaries to look for Daniel's new podcast, Messy, also coming out from Solid Gold in the fall or in the autumn. We're all very excited to hear that. And it just remains for me to say, Daniel Atland, thank you so much for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.